The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Verso Goodness.
And I'm William Goodenough.
The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you care to, you can send us actual letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806.
The show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee. Located at 610 Haywood Road, Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop.
This week, we play a brief segment of last week's conversation we couldn't air for reasons of length with Ori Lumumba, who talks about former Black Panther, political prisoner, and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mumia was sentenced to the Mumia was given the death penalty for the shooting death of Officer Daniel Faulkner of the Philadelphia PD in 1981. We talk about medical maltreatment of Mumia over the last year concerning his prior undiagnosed type 2 diabetes and hepatitis C. He contracted Hep C in 1981 from a blood transfusion related to the shooting surrounding his arrest. Mumia and his supporters have always declared his innocence in the case, and are now trying to get access for Mumia and the other 10,000 prisoners in the state of Pennsylvania who are known to have Hep C, but which the government is denying treatment due to the cost. For more info on Mumia's incarceration, writings, and activism, check out freemumia.com. And for his and others' radio commentaries, check out the amazing project prisonradio.org.
Following this, we speak with Petey, a supporter of Nicole Kissane and Joseph Budenberg, two animal activists living in the Bay Area facing charges of conspiracy under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Petey talks about the people, about the case so far, and a bit about the potential of a chilling effect left by ATA terrorism charges on the animal rights and animal liberation movements in the U.S. More on the case can be found at supportnicoleandjesse.com.
But first, this announcement. In December of 2012, Skanska USA was granted a contract from the University of Washington for the development and construction of the Animal Research and Care Facility, the secret underground lab intended to centralize animal research and vastly increase the number of animals that will be caged, abused, and killed. It was at this moment that Skanska chose to involve itself with the vivisection industry and to profit from the imprisonment and torture of endless generations of animals by literally burying them underground. They were eagerly prepared to make millions. What they were not prepared for was for the animal liberation movement. We here at The Final Straw Radio interviewed No New Animal Labs recently on the resistance to the Skanska USA lab at UW. In light of the contract being granted to Skanska USA, the No New Animal Labs initiative is calling for supporters to
hashtag
Storm Skanska, Swarm New York, from January 15th to 17th of 2016. To find out more and get involved, check out nonewanimallab.com.
I'm not dead. Well, I'm still alive. This is really awkward. I didn't plan on this. The current suspension of my communication started at the end of August. The fascists simply cut off all my outgoing communication, the equivalent to putting duct tape on my face. This is part of the pattern. Fascists suspended my communications in January to stop me from producing video talking about my innocence in my criminal case. They shut down my communications again in May when I wrote a statement in opposition to the international crime of torture. No good deed goes unpunished. Shortly after my communications resumed, fascists suspended them again with no explanation at all, apparently because they just don't like me. The message being sent is pretty clear. Until I embrace George W. Bush and Jesus, until my thinking conforms to what the ODRC likes, I have to shut up forever. All of this occurred, by the way, while my legal counsel, Richard Kerger, stood on the sidelines with a burger and a beer, spectating. Kerger gave them permission with his inaction. Attorneys are worthless. What do you call 10,000 attorneys buried up to their necks on the beach at low tide? A damn good start. So just to explain, this may seem like a situation that is just a minor annoyance, like being grounded off the phone in high school. But there's also the psychological effect, the constant sense of precarity and anxiety, the knowledge of being under attack in a million small ways, of being totally helpless as repression grinds on and on. And in my situation, it wasn't that communication suspensions would end and I could return to normal. There is a kind of cumulative effect from the suspension after suspension that wears on you. This current suspension began almost immediately after the last one ended, and it didn't just wear on me. It wears on those who care about me. Humans are social animals, after all. My elderly parents, who are very much not anarchists, suffer continuing harm. My dad was throwing up blood and was hospitalized and had not heard from me for months. Just recently, my mom fell and cracked ribs while trying to care for my dad. I have to think that their slow recoveries are due at least in part to not having any communications with their only child for months. Isan, still recovering from the strokes, still needing encouragement and human connection, has also been harmed. Others too. Part of what makes the situation psychologically tortuous is the sense that this will go on forever and ever, that the fascists will just keep silencing me until I agree to stop communicating, until I give up attempting to tell the truth. CIA manuals speak to inflicting this kind of psychological pain in order to diminish a subject's motivational strength. As the CIA describes, such a program of deprivation, quote, induces regression by depriving the subject's mind of contact with an outer world and thus forcing it in on itself, end quote. So, as a consequence, someone in this kind of situation, due to the psychological pain, regresses and becomes less and less able to focus on anything more than the psychological pain and the subject's own situation. As humans, we become neutralized then, not just by the logistical hassle of communication suspensions, but we become unable to focus on anything beyond our own situations, our own psychological pain. In my own situation, that means I'm not only blocked from knowing what's going on in the world and then weighing in on issues, but the immediate psychological pain forces me to focus on nothing else. It sucks. So, all of this taken together, my permanent neutralization, it seems, along with the fact that I'm now being used as a weapon to hurt people I love, got me to thinking about something my grandmother told me. My grandmother feared being unable to care for herself, being put into a home. She often told me that there were worse things than death, and there's nothing worse than outliving yourself. So, in the midst of this permanent isolation where I'm now used to hurt those I love, I drew a reasonable conclusion, I think, that I have outlived me. I decided to forego my blood pressure meds until my communications resumed. And I also know the ODRC would not resume the communications, so I would have to quit the meds. I've been on them for 10 years, and quitting cold turkey causes a blood pressure spike, which could lead to strokes, aneurysms, heart attacks. So I wrote some really self-important diatribes in the form of legal declarations in order to get them out of the prison, and I quit the meds, knowing the ODRC wouldn't budge. I expected that in about 72 hours, I would fall over dead. All of your savages would read my profound words of great power, and you'd take up your machetes to hack civilization to pieces. You know, in love and rage and all that. Then I didn't die. I quit my meds and finalized all my affairs, and nothing happened. It's been weeks. I've been awaiting my dramatic sputtering out. Not even chest pains. I didn't count on this. It appears I'm going to be around for a while, so I better find something to talk about. This is so embarrassing. For better or for worse, this is still anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from inside the Ohio Torture Complex. If you're listening, you are the resistance. You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
Mr. Lumumba, you also work with the International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. I know we've covered a lot of information this hour, but it seems fitting to talk about Mumia since we've been speaking about the Black Panthers and the MOVE organization. Can you briefly tell listeners about who Mumia is?
Mumia Abu-Jamal is another United States political prisoner. Mumia, former member of the Black Panther Party, a longtime supporter of the MOVE organization. Mumia Abu-Jamal was a journalist, a revolutionary journalist, who in the 70s gained the name of the voice of the voiceless, meaning that he gained a reputation for speaking up for oppressed people that couldn't speak up for themselves. As a journalist, you know, he did radio shows on police brutality, against unemployment, against so many different things. And this made Mumia a target of the Philadelphia police in the very late 70s, early 80s. In fact, when the MOVE 9 was arrested on August 8, 1978, and there was a press conference at City Hall, then Mayor Frank Rizzo, that day at the press conference, threatened Mumia. He singled Mumia out and threatened him, stating that he's going to see to it that one day Mumia pays for his brand of journalism. And they attempted that on December 9, 1981. This government made its first attempt on the life of Mumia Abu-Jamal, with Philadelphia police shot Mumia and almost killed him December 9, 1981. In their failure to kill Mumia, another officer, Daniel Faulkner, was killed. And Mumia was charged and convicted and given a death penalty for the murder of Officer Daniel Faulkner, despite the fact that there was clear evidence showing that Mumia didn't have a fair trial, also showing that he was innocent. On July 4th weekend, 1982, Mumia was sentenced to death. Mumia spent about 31 years on death row in the state of Pennsylvania. He's published several books from death row. In August of 95, this government attempted to kill Mumia yet again when they tried to sign a death warrant to have him executed through lethal injection. They failed due to the power and the public, power of the public and the people. Again, this government attempted to murder Mumia in 99 through lethal injection. And again, it was the power of the people that saved Mumia's life. Due to the overwhelming pressure, this system had to eventually take our brother Mumia off of death row in 2012, and we sentenced him to life without parole. This was due to the overwhelming amount of worldwide pressure that was put on this government about Mumia. But that wasn't enough. When Mumia was taken off of death row, the then widow of police officer Daniel Faulkner said, Mumia is going to pay. Now that he's leaving death row, he doesn't have the luxuries afforded to him. He's going to be amongst his people, the murderers, the rapists, and the thieves in general population. And they're going to see to it that he pays for this. You know, so for over 30 years, Mumia from death row, from prison, has stayed committed to putting out the truth, doing what a journalist is supposed to do, report the truth truthfully.
And Mumia's been, more recently since he's been back in general population, and just over this last year, he's been suffering from a number of medical issues that supporters of Mumia have said, and Mumia's own voice, have said he has not been getting proper treatment for. Can you talk about this?
Definitely. As I stated, the three attempts on Mumia's life by this government all failed. And now this government has made its fourth attempt on the life of Mumia, this time to kill Mumia through medical neglect. When Mumia came off of death row in 2011-2012, he was examined by the prison physician. And prison officials right then detected that Mumia had hepatitis C, and they said nothing. Mumia got hepatitis C December 9th, 1981, when he was shot by Philadelphia police. He had to receive like a blood transfusion while in the emergency room being operated on. And somehow through that, he contracted hepatitis C, which he kept for years. This past year, you know, 2015, Mumia was having like a skin condition where his skin was always itching, to the point where he broke out into like a full rash, like a full body rash. Every part of his body was covered in a rash. And it was like a real painful rash. When you go on a visit with Mumia, he would fall asleep on a visit because he would be so tired, like from not sleeping at night because of the painfulness of the skin condition.
Was it like a psoriasis?
Yeah, it was like a psoriasis. It was like an eczema type thing to the point where he was scratching so bad to where his skin would start bleeding. So it got to the point where another brother up there, Major Tillery, saw Mumia and said, "Man, Mumia, you don't look good at all. You need to go to the infirmary, you know?" And Mumia went. And now this is viewed as eczema. The prison doctor gave Mumia a steroid for eczema. Just when does someone get steroids for eczema, a skin rash or a skin condition? Which then caused Mumia to stay in the infirmary. Mumia was very weak. He's having several issues. To one point, he went to the bathroom, and he passed out in the bathroom. They had to take Mumia to an outside hospital where he went into diabetic shock. And we're talking diabetes. There was something happened with the medication that they gave Mumia, this steroid, which then raised his blood sugars and caused him to get diabetes. Diabetes. So it's been a long uphill battle these past couple of months. Like, Mumia was taken to an outside hospital twice, where he still has his skin condition that's getting better to the point where he was finally diagnosed with the hepatitis C, which explains the skin condition, the rash, everything. And prison officials have refused to treat Mumia for the hepatitis C, saying that he's not sick enough. Yet he's been in infirmary for just about all of this year. He's been taken to the outside hospital twice, has gone into diabetic shock, has this skin condition, and they said he's not sick enough yet to be treated for this. So recently, Mumia's attorneys filed a suit in the courts for Mumia and other men and women across the state of Pennsylvania to be treated for the hepatitis C to get the medication. So what started last week, December 18th, was a court hearing in Scranton, Pennsylvania, where the attorneys argued for the right for men and women across the state of Pennsylvania to receive this new hepatitis C treatment, which has a 90% cure rate that they're refusing to give because they don't want to spend the money or cut costs, you know. And what we found out in yesterday, the third day of the court hearing, is that the lawyer for the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections was falsifying documents in the court to try to cover the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections and their mishandling of Mumia and the whole medical situation with this matter. And the point I want to make is we have to be on our toes and observant and stay on this issue. This government has not let up in their fight to kill Mumia, and they're using this issue with the hepatitis C and the medical neglect to execute Mumia. And it's up to us to stop this. The issue of medical neglect runs rampant in the United States prison system, especially as it relates to our political prisoners. Robert Seth Hayes in New York State is suffering from medical neglect now. Albert Noah Washington died from medical neglect in New York State prison, as did Kawazi Balgoon, as did Teddy Jahit, Bashir Hamid, Richard Williams on the West Coast in the federal prison system. This government has not let up in its fight to kill Mumia, and it's up to us to stop it. This is no different than December 9th, 1981, August 1995, or October of 1999. Just how we saw the urgency and fought back then, we have to apply that same urgency now to save the life of our brother Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And especially considering the fact, the life of Mumia Abu-Jamal is definitely worth fighting for. But put within the context also of the fact that there's 10,000 other Pennsylvania prisoners infected with Hep C, it's not like they may be pinpointing against Mumia, but this is a massive problem that the supposed Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, you know, or Department of Corrections for Pennsylvania doesn't care enough about its, like, the people that it's supposed to be taking care of to rehabilitate and release back into the public, that they'd rather have them die of this long-term and painful disease. So
yeah, they would.
The fact that Mumia is standing up there and saying, like, yeah, okay, this is me, this is not only me, this is so many of us, I think is a really, like, upstanding and amazing thing, and allows us to draw a connection between supporting people who are in there for their political statements and actions and reporting in Mumia's case, as well as his activities in the Panther Party beforehand, but also connecting that with issues of mass incarceration, the new Jim Crow, the prison industrial complex within the United States.
Definitely. Because like I said, Mumia never speaks out about himself. He always speaks for all other men and women out there being oppressed. That's why so many men and women that's named in this suit as well, around the issue of the hepatitis C treatment, you know? And unfortunately, some people, they can't speak up for themselves or not willing to. And that's why Mumia got the name, the voice of the voiceless, you know? And yeah, this drill, because the issue of hepatitis C in the United States prison system overall is a huge issue. Hep C has run rampant in the United States prison system for years. I remember when the late, great Safia Bakari wrote an article and spoke out about this in the very late 90s. Now, hepatitis C has just exploded across prisons in the United States.
It's incredible. Well, Ori, what's up next with this court case? How can people pay attention to as it proceeds, what's going on with it, and keep up on Mumia's health, or get involved in sponsoring events for him, or you know, keeping up to date and keeping active around Mumia's case?
People can go to www.freemumia.com. They can go there for more information on what's going on with the court hearings and the current information with Mumia and what they can do and stuff. Again, they can go to www.freemumia.com.
Mumia in the past has also become known, even after his time, like after his imprisonment, for us younger folks who weren't in the Philly area and didn't get to hear his reporting at the time. Like, he's been involved with Noel Hanrahan's amazing radio project, Prison Radio, which gets sampled by numerous radio stations and shows around the country. Democracy Now! Airs it occasionally. I know Flashpoints out of KPFA was airing it for a while. But that sits online along with the commentaries of numerous other political prisoners and commentators at like on Prison Radio's website. I was just about to look up what the website is. Mumia has also written a number of books, writes commentaries and articles on a regular basis, and is just an amazing, well-honed journalist. And if nothing else, people should definitely check out his past writings. I think articles and such are available at freemumia.com, right?
Yes, indeed. They could go to prisonradio.org, or they could go to www.freemumia.com.
And now a conversation with Petey about Nicole and Joseph's case. So we're joined by a supporter of Nicole Kissane and Joseph Buddenberg, two animal rights activists residing in the Bay Area who were arrested in July of 2015 and were indicted by a federal grand jury under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Thank you very much for chatting with me about this.
Thanks for having me.
Do you want to introduce yourself or remain anonymous?
No, I'll go ahead and introduce myself. My name is Petey. I'm with the Nicole and Joseph support team, and it's a support team that came together the weekend that Nicole and Joseph were arrested, and we've continued to work together ever since then. I remember when Joseph first called me that afternoon. It was a Friday afternoon, July 24th, and getting the news that him and Nicole were arrested that morning. I think it was like around 9:30 that morning by the FBI at their apartment. And I remember thinking immediately, who would want to come together and collaborate? to form a support team for Nicole and Joseph. And then when I got off the phone and I continued to kind of make some notes and think about it and ask others who they thought would also be interested in coming together, I myself spent a lot of time reaching out, thinking about supporting and acting in defense of defendants in political cases. And then if it gets to this point, political prisoners, and then just generally those resisting repression every day. I mean, that's really what I spend the majority of my time on. And then all of a sudden, it's a little different when those individuals are people you're close to. I'm on this every day. And so for that, I definitely thank you for having me on.
Definitely. Thanks a lot for making the time in the middle of the holiday season to chat. Can you tell listeners a little bit about Nicole and Joseph? Who are they and what sorts of activism are they involved in?
Well, I guess I could take this opportunity to plug the website, supportnicoleandjoseph.com. And I'm guessing you'll give me a couple other opportunities to support that site. But anyway, two of the most clicked on pages I've noticed on that site is one page titled "Who is Nicole?" and another page titled "Who is Joseph?" And I think that's great. I think it's great that people want to get to know Nicole and Joseph a little. Granted, those summaries are a bit brief, but nevertheless, it kind of gets you to understand a little bit more about these individuals further than the case that they're defendants in. So if you head into the Who is Joseph page on the site, you'll go ahead and check out that last line maybe and find out that he's currently reading Kafka as his life continues on this Kafka-esque path of terrorism task forces and false accusations. In 2009, Joseph was one of four individuals indicted in federal court for violation of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. That was the charge. And basically, they were accused of this for essentially organizing anti-vivisection protests in Northern California. The case went on for about a year and a half, but in the end, the charges were dropped for all four defendants. And, you know, I guess if you spend a little bit more time on that page, you'll also come to find out that that he likes 90s hip hop and is actually working on a stand-up routine. He considers himself an aspiring comedian. Nicole is relatively new to the Bay Area. And growing up in Southern California, she ended up getting involved in some protesting around some different animal rights campaigns in the San Diego and Los Angeles area. She's 29 and has been vegan since 16. And I guess if anybody in the San Diego area heads to court for court support, would also come to find out that she's got style.
Style and grace.
yeah, absolutely.
And what's she reading right now?
What is she reading right now? I don't know, honestly. She's actually taking a jewelry making class. So I know she's getting into like different books that are applicable to like the actual class itself and getting more into fitness and cooking, so different things like that that are kind of go hand in hand with those different interests.
They're obviously both folks that are between the veganism and the history of protest around vivisection, folks that are like very much concerned with animal welfare. In fact, in the picture in Nicole's Who is Nicole page, or about Nicole, is a picture of a very cute puppy dog being held. So maybe you can frame it for listeners. How is it that they're facing terrorism charges for allegedly releasing animals and damaging property?
Okay, well, let me go and clarify something here at this point. Nicole and Joseph both have one single charge. That's where this case gets really interesting, in my opinion. And they are charged in federal court with conspiracy to I'm sorry, I want to highlight the conspiracy, you know, conspiracy to violate the Animal and Enterprise Terrorism Act. That single charge carries, if convicted, carries a maximum of 10 years in federal prison.
The conspiracy charge does, not even like breaking anything specifically under the ETA, but just the conspiracy to go against ETA.
So, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The allegations of property destruction, the allegations of releasing animals, they are not actually charged with any of those acts. Those allegations are listed in the indictment because the government is going to try and argue that those many actions that Nicole and Joseph are alleged to have committed are actually merely two or more people acting in concert, and then there has to be overt acts to make up the conspiracy. And here there's 31 listed, and there's a variety of different things in those 31 acts, 31 overt acts that they're arguing that would make up the conspiracy. One is a property destruction that occurred at a First Store in San Diego. And then there's multiple different acts of releasing animals in different states throughout the country. Then there's also actually withdrawing $300 from an ATM in San Francisco. So these are all these overt acts. I mean, those are some of them. I mean, again, there's a list of 31 that the government's going to argue that would make up the conspiracy. And then again, plug in the website again, those who follow the website and those who are keeping up with the case would understand that, Nicole and Joseph are, have every intention of taking this to trial. So, at that point, again, that's where the prosecution will have to convince the jury these overt acts were committed, and then that they are substance to then make up the conspiracy and have to convince the jury that Nicole and Joseph in fact did conspire to violate the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And I think at that point I'd like to, if you don't mind, spend a little bit of time talking about especially when you bring up, when you kind of, highlight terrorism as if it's a shocking thing that would be utilized here. And it's interesting when you think about when the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act was authored and then passed in 2006. And in the statute, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act statute, it states that it prohibits prohibits any person from engaging in certain conduct for the purpose of damaging or interfering with the operations of an animal enterprise. And I feel like that was passed I think that it's just fact that was passed after pressure from the industry or industries that utilize animals to have more for the government to have more tools at their disposal to prosecute, apprehend, and then convict, and hopefully, as far as the government's concerned and the industries are concerned, to hand out lengthier sentences. So I feel like if you look back from 2006 back to like the mid 90s, there was a lot of pressure put on these industries by activists to end their abusive practices. And this came in the form of pressure campaigns, lots of marches, protests, sit-ins, or even, what's considered lockdowns. Those were all in the form of, protest campaigns. And then also, you know, starting in the mid-90s, there was a large amount, year after year, of underground activity. And that's anonymous individuals going out at night, maybe damaging property or liberating animals from captivity. And when there's not a lot of convictions and not a lot of what maybe these industries consider as, what do you want to call it, like individuals with long sentences who would set an example for those who would set out at night and you know, do something.
Sort of have like a chilling effect or be used as an example.
Right. Mm-hmm. And if there's not that, then they're going to be concerned that this is only going to continue. So they wanted to clearly start putting pressure on the federal government to do more to stop this. So if large sentences are handed out, and if overly aggressive forms of prosecution occur, it's going to be a lot more accepted by the general public if the government can successfully convict us as terrorists, because then it's not as much of a surprise that these absurd sentences were handed out or these absurd tactics are utilized. You know, great example is as I was talking about earlier with Joseph's previous federal case back in 2009, where the charges ended up being dropped. You know, I mean, the terrorism was used there too. I mean, he and his three other co-defendants were charged with the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act or in violation of it. And again, you know, these individuals were merely accused of organizing protests against vivisectors. So the government was using that statute to try and, you know, criminalize them, you know, and you know, demonize them even further. And I don't know. I mean, I feel like, you know, it really points to, I feel like I use all that and talk about all that from, you know, where I start from the mid-90s and where it brings us to 2006 when that statute was passed. Because it really seems like, you know, you can look throughout history and whenever there's a social justice movement having an effect on the industry that they're opposing, or in other cases, maybe having an effect opposing a particular, you know, government, then it should really be no surprise when any type of tactic of repression occurs. Where there's effectiveness, you know, there's going to be repression in response.
And even during the 90s, as has been pointed out before, and a lot of the narrative that you're describing right now was covered by Green is the New Red very well by Will Potter and continues to be. But the Animal Liberation Front as an organization or a network or a tendency, along with the Earth Liberation Front, were both considered to be terrorist organizations, despite the fact that they didn't cause any human, like any damage to humans. They never hurt any person. If anything, they released animals from being hurt. And the terrorism is actually, it's like, just for the little logical leap, I just want to bring this up or say it again, I guess, is that for terrorism to be applied in a way that's specifically talking about a deterrent to an industry as opposed to a threat of physical harm or endangerment, when in fact these acts are relieving animals, non-human animals, from acts of endangerment like vivisection or like slaughtering for meat or fur or whatever. It's just, it's such a mind-blowing thing. And I know that this is like far from the only time that terrorism gets applied to a specific political movement or ethical movement. For instance, it's used as a silencing tool of a lot of like minority ethnic and religious populations within the US and within a lot of other countries. Muslim, for instance, since 9/11. But it's just mind blowing. I just wanted to say that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I feel like I don't want to get so wrapped up on the word terrorism or terrorist, because I feel like, I wouldn't want to think it's not to be utilized here and it should be utilized elsewhere, or to give the government any credence, when utilizing that term. As you said, it's probably most utilized in labeling the Muslim population at this point, and to further criminalize Muslims in general. And again, it's not that surprising to me that it's used here or, in this particular circumstance in trying to put a stop to this level of activity in defense of animals. It's also not a surprise to me that it's used in a xenophobic, racist context in describing Muslims. I don't know. I mean, I feel like the government is merciless, and they're going to label, individuals who are organizing protests in defense of animals as terrorists if they feel like it's advantageous to them, and they're gonna label, Muslims as terrorists if they feel like it's advantageous to them as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So outside of like not getting hung up on the terrorist label, if this is like a regular strategy that's being normalized and attacking animal activists, do you have ideas about how we can work to resist that normalization?
Well, I feel like it's when government repression various different tactics of government repression sort of catches us off guard, you use this term or you use the word normalization. And I feel like if we sort of understand that this is normalized, this is normal, then we'll kind of understand how we want to sort of weave through it. And, honestly, even embrace it in order to find strength in it, because animal rights movement, animal liberation movement, and a lot of other social justice movements, they're kind of chosen in a sense. You can individuals can choose to step into it, and individuals can choose to step out of it. And then I don't want to take it away from anyone who does find that passion and really can't think of, any other way that they want to, that they would want to live their life other than in defense of animals, or any other social justice cause that you could kind of think of as some sort of chosen idea. But even when you think of it in that way, you have to kind of take into consideration all the different possible tactics that the government is going to use, and be prepared for it, and continue to go further with everything that they throw at you. So you have this particular situation, and here, all that Nicole and Joseph are facing every day throughout this case, and all that they go through. And then all that you may go through by standing in solidarity or standing in defense of Nicole and Joseph, you just do it. You just go through with it and you move forward, and you learn from it, and you learn from past cases of repression and past political cases and what was utilized maybe to win that case. There are examples of victories. I mean, I think as in social justice movements, we spend a lot of time, thinking about the worst case scenario and the fact that there's a lot of these, convictions. And we don't think about a lot of the victories that have happened. But going back to, my train of thought I feel like when Joseph was first put on house arrest, and then, even Nicole not being on house arrest, shortly after the initial arrest on July 24th. You know, this is a federal indictment. And again, like we talked about before, you know, they're being charged with a statute where there's terrorism in the title. So I wouldn't be surprised if good friends or people that were, you know, just maybe beginning to get close with Nicole and Joseph would start to distance themselves out of fear of, you know, what may happen to them. Because now they're associating with two individuals who are under federal indictment and maybe if at one point back in May, you were damn excited to go on a hike with your friend, Nicole, you know, maybe you're having a second thought now and going to spend time with Joseph while he's on house arrest at his place. Maybe you're reconsidering that because of the situation, but you know what? I haven't seen that. I haven't seen any of that. And that's really, really exciting and really inspiring to not see that. But again, when it's a chosen movement or a chosen cause, you can step in and step out. But when it's, say, for example, a indigenous community that's resisting repression, there is no stepping in and stepping out. That is your life that you're fighting for. So every bit of repression that comes your way, you have to learn from it, and find strength with how you respond to it and how you may want to change the response in the future, possibly. Trans individuals, people of color, you know, we brought up Muslims earlier, you know, I mean, these are all individuals who end up, you know, fighting for their lives. But again, even in these, chosen situations, as I'm describing them, I'm white man, you know, I definitely became radicalized and as a teenager and I'm still here now at 35, you know. So I really like to learn from history and learn from those who are experiencing repression in other parts of the country or other parts of the world, even, so we can continue to move forward and understand that the normalization is just something to accept and something to understand. Repression is going to happen if we're going to be effective, as we talked about in response to the last question. You know, something I think about a lot is the control units that occurred in the 80s. There was the control unit St. Marion, Illinois, at the U.S. Penitentiary in Marion, and then there was the control units at Lexington, Kentucky, the federal prison for women in Lexington, Kentucky. And the political prisoners were sent to three particular political prisoners were sent to the control units in Lexington, Kentucky, as the first individuals to be kind of positioned there, so they can kind of see how it goes and see how it works and see how it's going to be. And as political prisoners, you know, one of them being Alejandrina Torres, one of Puerto Rican political prisoners, Susan Rosenberg, Sylvia Baraldini, you know, these were individuals who were already sentenced to a very lengthy sentences, and I'd imagine they were in the understanding that there was going to be some tough situations that they were going to come across as political prisoners that the government was going to send their way, and these control units were part of that, some of that, then there was this outside campaign that went on in 1987, when that worked hard to close down the Lexington control units, and they did in 1989. And then Susan Rosenberg ended up being granted release by Clinton. So did Alejandrina Torres. And then later on, Sylvia Baraldini was the campaign to get her to Italy was successful. And then she was eventually didn't have to serve her complete time in Italy either. And, you know, so people who understand, you know, what the government is going to, you know, attack you with as somebody who is not exiting a social justice movement, who is continuing to push forward. They're going to hand you anything that they can think of, anything that will try and put a stop to you. I mean, those Lexington control units were a clear, thing of, like, again, you know, like what you and I talked about earlier of making an example out of somebody, you know, this is what would happen, you know, but the movement outside showed, well, you know what, we're going to shut you down. And they did. And so I guess all I'm trying to say is I feel like, you know, we have to continue to move forward. We can't spend so much time worrying about repression. We should understand that repression is always around the corner and is always ahead of us. And learning from the past, learning from what happens in other parts of the country, other parts of the world, and continue to move forward. And resist repression in that sense.
Where are the cases of Nicole and Joseph at right now? Are there any upcoming court dates or points of actions that listeners can help with?
Let's see. So there was a lengthy report back from last court date, which was December 21st down in San Diego. The crux of the court date was basically to try and move the case up to Oakland. The Nicole and Joseph's lawyers were arguing to move the case up to Oakland and arguing for, arguing hardship, basically, and saying that if Nicole and Joseph continue to travel down to San Diego and, you know, take a day off work, multiple days off work, and, you know, the travel, just the stress that travel is, San Diego is not close at all to Oakland. It's about a 9-hour trek. Less 18 hours round trip if you're driving. So anyway, you know, there was a lot of good arguments brought up by Nicole and Joseph's lawyers to try and bring the case from San Diego up to Oakland. And ultimately the judge, you know, seemed to take interest in some of the arguments, but then in the end seemed to take interest in too many of the arguments to keep the case in San Diego, and is going to give their lawyers one more opportunity to argue to bring the case up to Oakland on March 1st, where there's a motions hearing. But that opportunity seems like a opportunity to argue to basically change venue, just bring bring the case up to Oakland for trial, where the judge would probably travel, the prosecutor would probably travel. So it's almost just like, you know, going from one venue to another after the lawyers, Nicole and Joseph's lawyers, would hopefully successfully argue that hardship idea again. Beyond that, you know, it's moving forward. The defense is preparing with the discovery that prosecution has handed over, and they're working as a team. Nicole and Joseph seem to be very satisfied with their lawyers, and their lawyers are interested and maybe even excited to work as a team, and they're preparing ideas and strategies to fight the case. It's a shame. It's definitely a shame. One thing that comforted me or gave me comfort was the fact that there was quite a bit of support at the last court date in San Diego. People came from LA area and the San Diego area, and then a few of us came down from Northern California. And so that was good to see. And I think, and it seems clear that that'll only continue as we get closer to that March 1st court date, and then ultimately trial. Seems like the support in the Southern California area will continue to develop. As far as conditions of bail, also at the last court date, there was a bit of a victory where Joseph's lawyer argued to have the house arrest restrictions eased, to the point where Joseph would just have his curfew. So now he has to be in his apartment from 6 p.m. to 7 a.m. But beyond that, he has much more latitude in that period of time from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. throughout the day. And, you know, they both are on a federal pretrial probation.
How are they about receiving letters at this point? Is that, I mean, they're still going through the court situation, so it's not like they're behind bars at the moment.
They're not, no. But I mean, I definitely wouldn't, deter anyone from doing that. I mean, there's the P.O. box that's available on the website, and we made the P.O. box available because we know not everyone is interested in utilizing PayPal, so people can send money to the P.O. box to donate to the support fund. And you could also add a note there saying you'd like a few stickers, buttons, or a T-shirt. Write a letter to Nicole, you know, write a letter to Joseph and let him know, you know, you heard this on The Final Straw and you want to show your support. You know, maybe it's a short note, short letter, but, the individual down there in Santa Cruz, you know, sees, you know, does get a chance to see them quite often. I'm sure that note would be delivered and I'm sure Nicole and Joseph would really appreciate it.
And there's a few benefits that have been art show benefits that have been put on in San Francisco and a concert in San Francisco and an art show benefit in Portland. That's a good opportunity to draw together members of your community to try to raise some money and also have chances to make face-to-face connections with people and talk about this case and similar cases and repression going on. And also, like you said, the good stuff, the examples of when we succeed and when we win.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love hearing about those benefits and, you know, outreach events. There was a punk rock karaoke in Brooklyn pretty soon after the arrest. I think it was organized pretty quickly, and I think it happened about maybe a month and a half after the arrest, and that was great. And then as you mentioned, there was an art show in Portland, a punk show in San Francisco, you know, and these are great opportunities to raise awareness about Nicole and Joseph's case and their situation. You always think that, you know, word is getting out, and then all of a sudden you realize, you know, it can always, you know, it, you know, it, we can always go even a lot further. And especially when it comes to other parts of the country, you know, maybe not catching wind of things right away. And then certainly other parts of the world, in the beginning, we were certainly getting messages from New Zealand and Australia and the UK, but, you know, I definitely want to, you know, keep doing outreach and keep getting the word out about Nicole and Joseph so that interest continues and that, it being spread around, you know, only continues, of course. The website covers a lot. And then even in general resources around repression or, you know, again, as I was talking about earlier, keeping your kind of head up and eyes open about, you know, different repression tactics. On the resources page, there's actually a couple different pieces of literature that you could click on and download and check that out. And there's a great book out, where it's been out for quite a long time, called The War at Home. And that's by Brian Glick. And that's a great book. I mean, he goes back into social justice movements from the 60s and 70s and early 80s. And I think there's a lot to gain. It's a short book, but it's a great resource as far as understanding repression. Thanks so much for having me on. And yeah,
absolutely. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness.
And I'm William Goodenough. #HashBrown.